Shall we turn now in our Bibles to the 9th chapter of the book of Genesis? In chapter 8, we found that Noah had emerged out of the ark, and God had given to him the promise that as long as the earth remained, it would remain in its orbit. It would continue to spin upon its axis. That there would be summer and winter. Springtime or seed time and harvest. There would be day and night and there would be cold and heat. So having emerged now from the ark, chapter 9, God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Notice the command is to fill the earth. As we get into chapter 11, we'll find a rebellion against that command as they decided to build a civilization and a urbanized community in the area of Babylon, Shinar, the Mesopotamian plain. But God's command was to fill the earth. And God said he would put the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, every bird of the air that moves on the earth, and all of the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. So pretty much again, a man to be ruler over the earth and over the created things upon the earth. Man's dominion. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. Prior to the flood, a man was a vegetarian. Now God allows man to eat meat. I have given you all things, even as I gave to you the vegetables, but you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is its blood. Now, God early is giving to man a respect for blood. Later on, we will be told that the life of the flesh is in the blood. And he is not to eat that which has its blood in it. Of course, the Jewish people to the present day follow very strictly this command. And thus, a Orthodox Jew would not buy meat in your butcher shop where you buy your meat. They will only buy meat that is certified kosher, that is meat where the rabbi has observed the butchering process and has made sure that the animals were thoroughly bled so that you will not be getting the blood with the flesh. This is something that God restricted when he talked, when he gave to man now that broadening of his diet into meat. There was not to be the blood within the meat. This is something that, of course, became more completely codified under the law of Moses, but you see where it antedates the law here in Genesis. And in the New Testament, when they sought to determine the relationship that the Gentile believer would have to the law, they told them to keep themselves from idols and from fornication, and from things strangled. If you strangle the animal that you're going to eat, then the blood gets locked in the flesh. So they were exhorted not to eat things that were strangled. So it is a prohibition that carried on to the Gentile believers in the early church. Surely for your lifeblood will I demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast will I require it, and from the hand of man. From the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Now, God here is talking about the sacredness of life, and he is establishing now a new order, a new law. You remember when Cain killed his brother, God allowed Cain to go ahead and to continue to live, cursed, marked, but yet no man was to take his life because he had taken his brother's life. But here we find God is now establishing human government with Noah. And in the establishment of human government, God establishes capital punishment. And so it is here established and becomes a biblical injunction. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply in it. And so the establishment of whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. As we get further into the law, again, we'll find that this is codified and God sets out the laws for manslaughter. If you have killed someone by accident, how that there would be the city of refuge where you could flee. And they could not avenge the death of their family because of your accident or your negligence. And also it was established the killing of a person in a fit of rage, which we call second degree murder today, and then the first degree murder, which was the premeditated and deliberate planned murder of a person. And that is the one where capital punishment was always to be enacted upon the perpetrator of such a crime. So capital punishment is something that was established by God early in the history of mankind. And I think today that those sob sisters that object to capital punishment are totally inconsistent in their objections. I find it very difficult to handle when persons like Jane Fonda cries so much about the horrible things we were doing in Vietnam to those poor innocent Vietnamese and gets on this whole big crusade to get us out of Vietnam and all, and goes and visits Hanoi and gives comfort to the enemy and tells of what wonderful, loving, peace-loving people they are, and how she's on this big crusade. Until when these beautiful, loving, peace-loving home people invade Cambodia and begin to systematically slaughter the Cambodians, where is her objections then? Why isn't she out now, you know, trying to tell us that we ought to, you know, be against them because they're slaughtering a group of people? I mean, there's a total inconsistency. We heard so much cry about the Shah of Iran, how that he was oppressing certain people, you know, and this business of human rights were being thwarted under the Shah's reign. Why aren't they then doing the same kind of parading and placard carrying and picketing now that the Ayatollah is doing much more than the Shah ever thought of doing? You know, they complain about the Somoza regime in Nicaragua and all the human rights violations. But what about the Sandinistas who systematically have sought to eliminate a whole section of the community, this Mosquitos Indian tribes? Why aren't they out with their placards now? There's just a complete inconsistency. And if you ask me, it stinks. At least it smells suspicious. God established capital punishment. And I believe that it is the basis for human government. And I personally feel that when a person willfully, deliberately takes another man's life, he has sacrificed his own right to live. And I believe by man should his life be taken under the judicial system. You say, could you pull the switch? You bet I could. Especially if it was one of my family that had been brutally slain by that individual. You wouldn't even have to give me a switch. Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, "And as for me, behold, I establish my covenant." So God is now establishing this covenant. Remember the earlier covenant, the summer, winter, and all. "Now, my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, every beast of the earth, and all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth, thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." Now, there is, in certain quarters, argumentation that the flood was a local situation. It happened only in the Euphrates Valley, that it was just a local flood. There are those who espouse this, but, you know, it doesn't have to be a worldwide flood that the Bible actually teaches, but it could have been just a local origin. Well, there are problems with that. Number one, why would God have him spend 120 years building an ark to escape it? Why not just move him over to the next valley? And if the ark indeed rests on Mount Ararat, which is 17,000 feet high, it would be difficult to pile water that deep in one section of the world without it sort of leveling out and covering the whole earth. But the real problem lies in this covenant of God. If it were only a local flood and God promises he's never going to flood the earth again, like he did, then God hasn't kept his promises, because we've had local floods. Areas have been devastated by local floods. Even here in California, we talk about the 100-year flood. I remember the last one in 1938, when the Santa Ana River filled the whole valley from here clear on over to Huntington Beach. That whole area, if you live in Fountain Valley, was underwater. I don't mean to alarm you. But if God is only talking, I mean, if it's only a local flood situation, then God didn't keep his promise, because there have been local floods. But the promise in the covenant is there would not be again a flood to destroy the earth. Now, we do know that God is going to destroy the earth again, but not by a flood of water, but by fire. And God said, "This is the sign of the covenant which I will make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for the perpetual generations. I will set my rainbow in the cloud. It shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. And so it shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant which is between me and you and every living creature and all the flesh of the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all of the flesh that is on the earth. And so God's covenant, and he established it with the rainbow. And of course, after the flood, the earth became watered by rain. It had not rained prior to the flood. And we know that the rainbows are caused by the prisms formed in the droplets of water with a black background of a cloud and the sun shining upon the water that is falling. It forms that beautiful rainbow through the prisms, and it's just a glorious sight to behold. But the rainbow, again, should remind you of the faithfulness of God's promise and not to destroy the earth with the flood. Now the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham was the father of Canaan. Now these three were the sons of Noah. And from these the whole earth was populated. So we tonight can trace ourselves back to a common ancestry, to Noah. And we are the descendants of one of the three sons of Noah. Noah began to be a farmer. He planted a vineyard. Then he drank of the wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. Now, there are those who suggest that this possibly was an accident, that somehow the wine did not ferment, or the juice did not ferment prior to the flood. We do know that the cosmic radiation does cause a souring process in milk. That milk that is protected completely from radiation can be kept fresh, unrefrigerated, for weeks. That it is in the radiation effects that the milk begins to sour, becomes curdled. And there is the suggestion that perhaps prior to the flood, the juice did not ferment, but now after the flood, with this blanket removed from around the earth, that moisture blanket, now with the earth receiving a much greater amount of radiation from the sun and from the space, that it caused the fermentation process and the juice turned to wine. I don't think that there is any real scriptural substantiation for such a claim. It is a possibility. It's one of those things you can't prove either way. But it's just that has been suggested by some, and I just thought I'd throw it out to you and you can throw it away. And there are those who say the wine in the Bible was not fermented wine, that it was just a form of juice. Well, he drank of the wine and was drunk. So that sort of knocks that theory in the head too. And he became uncovered in his tent. Now, whether or not he was just too drunk to know what he was doing, however he became uncovered is not told us, but he was uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, who was the youngest of his three sons, saw the nakedness of his father. The word saw there in the Hebrew is gazed intently, and there are those who would suggest he gazed in a sensual way at his father's nakedness and would suggest that there was a homosexual act by Ham committed against his father. However, that is, again, totally without scriptural substantiation. It does say in verse 24, when Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done to him, he cursed his grandson Canaan, knowing what Ham had done. But what was it that Ham had done? Was it a homosexual act, or was it just a fact that he sort of made fun of his father, went out and told the two brothers, thinking that they also would get a kick out of the old man's naked in the tent kind of a thing? The idea is probably the lack of showing respect to his father. The patriarchal society was extremely strong. In the scripture, the command was to honor your father and your mother. And it was something that was in the law, and it was also deeply enculturated, that respect and honor of your parents. His act against his father was a dishonorable act. And that is probably that which he had done, is the disrespect that he had for his father and his father's condition. And when he went out and told the two brothers, they showed great respect in that they took a garment and laid it on their shoulders, walked in backwards, and covered their father that they not see the nakedness of their father. And their faces were turned away from that. So that probably is the real reason why Noah, when he sobered up, was angry at Ham, is the disrespect that this son had, and the going out to his brothers and trying to make something out of the condition of their father. Interesting, isn't it, that though God destroyed the world with a flood, sin was not destroyed. It is still a part of man's nature and remains a part of man's nature. The sin nature of man is manifested very early in life. And it's always a very shocking and disappointing thing when we see the nature of sin manifested in our children. You know, you think they're little angels. And we talk about the innocency of these beautiful little children. Oh my, so sweet and so innocent. And they, with big, innocent looking eyes, can lie straight to you. Did you take a cookie? Oh no, Daddy, I didn't take a cookie. What are those chocolate crumbs on the corner of your mouth? I smelled it. Now, did you have to teach your children how to lie? No, you had to teach them to tell the truth. That's something that has to be instilled into a child. Has to be trained, has to be taught. Now, tell the truth. It's always better to tell the truth. You should always tell the truth. These are things we have to train the children. Why? Because they don't come by the truth naturally. But they find it very natural to lie. If you had some kind of a handicap, would you rather be put in a room with grown adults or with grown four-year-olds if you were handicapped? Now, if you're a room with grown adults, they have learned how to be discreet, respectful, kind towards a handicapped condition. But children aren't. And if you were put into a room of grown four-year-olds, you'd probably be beat to death because of your handicap. They wouldn't have the same mercy and attitude, but children can be extremely cruel towards a child that's different. And that child that's different has a hard time when it starts to school because of the cruelty of the other children who have not yet learned the graces. So the sinful nature, unfortunately, survived the flood. And though Noah, righteous in all of his generations, yet when he comes forth out of the ark, gets drunk, lies around naked, the sinful nature is still there. When he sobered up and realized what Ham had done, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants he shall be to his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. And may God enlarge Japheth, that he may dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant." Now, as we will get into chapter 11, and we find the various nations that descended from the three sons of Noah, we will find that this is more or less a prophecy of Noah. But at the onset, let me say that one of the worst perversions of Scripture is that fallacy that the curse upon Canaan was that he was to become black, and thus the black people are a servant race. That is not scriptural. It is a fallacy. There is nothing to it. It is a perversion that was developed by those men engaged in the slave trade in order to sort of assuage their own consciences over the horribly vile thing that they were doing. It is not scriptural. The descendants of Canaan actually were the ancient Phoenicians, who were one of the strongest, powerful people on the earth at one time, the Phoenician navies. It is also true that the Egyptians and those who are in Africa were also the descendants of Ham, but the fact that they should be, the servant class is not scriptural. It is not right. The word here would imply that these would be the people who would bring to man, and it has proven to be true, many of the advances in the fields of technology. They would be of service, really, to mankind, is the idea. And they have been of tremendous service to mankind. But it surely does not mean that they are to be slaves of the two brothers or to the descendants of the two brothers. That is a terrible perversion of the scriptures. We'll get to that further in chapter 11. Blessed be the Lord, or Jehovah, the God of Shem. And so here we get the indication that Shem would be the descendant of, among others, the Hebrew people. And through Shem would come Abraham, the line of which God would work in order to bring his son, the Messiah, into the world. So Jehovah, the God of Shem. And may God enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem. And this indeed did come to pass, as the borders of Japheth were enlarged, and the descendants of Japheth actually have come to dwell in many places in the land, or in the places of Shem, in the tents of Shem. Now Noah lived after the flood 350 years, and so here we find a blank in history of 350 years. Interesting, isn't it? Doesn't tell us any more. This is the end of Noah. Doesn't tell us anything else about Noah. This is the last thing. Is he was drunk and comes out of it and curses his grandson because of what his dad did, and that really ends for us the saga of this interesting man Noah. He's now out of the way for 350 years. But the fact that he lived 350 years means that he was still alive when Abraham was born, and lived contemporarily, in a contemporary period of time, with Abraham for 58 years. Abraham was 58 years old when Noah died. So it is quite possible that being a direct descendant of Noah through Shem, that Abraham talked to his great-great-great-great, how many generations back that would have been, grandfather, and could have heard the story of God's warning concerning the flood and all directly from Noah himself. With the longevity, we fail to see how that crosses several generations when you live to be 950 years old. And according to the scriptures, Noah was about the third as far as longevity that is recorded in the Word. And the interesting thing is that though there was probably tremendous climactic changes after the flood, and the increased cosmic radiation bombarding the earth, yet it did not have an immediate effect upon Noah, and began to gradually subside the ages of the people. There was a gradual decline in their lifespans. It wasn't just dramatically cut off, but there was a gradual decline of the lifespan until you get to Abraham's generation, and he lived to be an old man, 165 years old. But then it began and continued to decline from the time of Abraham until you get to a rough average of about 70 years old. So he lived after the flood for 350 years, and so the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. And so a quiet time of 350 years. Now, if you transport that to the present time, that would indicate a gap of history. If you went back 350 years from the present date, that would transport you way on back to the year of what, 15, 16 something. And so there'd be quite a gap in history. The United States being formed as a nation and all, you get back to before the Declaration of Independence and all, before the birth of our nation, if you had that kind of a gap. So it is quite a long gap in the space of history. Now as we get into chapter 10, this is commonly known as the Table of Nations. And so as we come into chapter 10, we see how that the three sons of Noah became the progenitors of the various nations of people. This is the genealogy of the sons of Noah: Shem, Ham, and Japheth. This genealogy was probably compiled by Shem, in that he only follows the descendants of his two brothers until about the time of Babel, when the nations were divided, the languages dividing the nations. And at that point, he doesn't follow the descendants of his two brothers any further, but does continue his own descendants. But in giving us the descendants of his two brothers, we get the ethnic origins of the various races of people. And beginning with his brothers, he takes, first of all, his older brother. The sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. Gomer was the progenitor of the Germanic people. Magog, the Scythians, and the Russian origins. Basically, the sons of Japheth were the progenitors of what are known as the Indo-European nations. And so those nations of Europe descended, we would say pretty much the Europeans, including the Russians, were the descendants of Japheth. Tubal goes back to of course, you know that in Russia there are many tribes. Madai is the Medes. Tubal is probably the origin of the name of Toblensk, the modern Russian city. And Meshech is the Muscovy or Moscow today. And so these are the descendants of Japheth. And from Gomer, the Ashkenaz. The Ashkenaz are again people of Germany, and those German Jews were called Ashkenazims. But the Ashkenaz are the descendants of Japheth. And Togarma, which are the southern European states, and basically Armenia. The Togarmans are the Armenians. The sons of Javan were Tarshish, which is thought to be possibly England. Tarshish was, as far as the scripture, just the end of the world. I mean, it was as far as you could go. That was the last outpost of the known civilization. You remember when Jonah went down to catch a ship to escape the call of God. He got a ship that was going to Tarshish. You can't go any further than that. And surely God doesn't dwell that far away. You know, I can escape the presence of God if I can just get to Tarshish. And so that was just the end of the world. But we do know that Solomon had ships that brought him tin and all from Tarshish. And Britannia was originally called Britannia because of the tin and the industry that was there. And so there are indications that Tarshish was the British Isles. Others seem to think Spain. But most of the evidence seems to lie with the British Isles, Tarshish. And so in that sense, probably the majority of us would be the descendants of Japheth, if you have a European type of background in your ancestry. If your ancestors came over on the Mayflower or whatever, then you probably pretty much are the descendants of Japheth. Interesting, remember the prophecy, they shall dwell in the tents of Shem. That is, when Shem, the descendants, rejected the Messiah, then basically it was the European nations that picked up in Christianity, and we dwell in the covering that God gave to Shem, that covering of Jesus Christ, and we've come to dwell in it and find our place of rest in it. And so it's an interesting fulfillment that it is basically the people of Japheth who have embraced the gospel and carried the gospel to the rest of the world in fulfillment of the prophecy of Noah how many thousands of years ago. Now, these are the families, and from these, the coastline peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his own language and according to the families into their nations. Now, you see, he at this point, this is the end of Japheth. He didn't carry him in too many generations, but they were then separated by their languages, which took place at the time of Babel in the next chapter. But he lost track of Japheth and his descendants once the Tower of Babel, and so he doesn't carry their ancestry any further, nor is it necessary. We are only interested in one line, and that is the line that will bring us to Abraham, and we'll let all of the rest of them go. We gradually narrow down and narrow down until we get to Abraham. And then we'll narrow down again until we get to David. And then we'll narrow down again until we get to Christ. And so the Bible is only interested in bringing us one line of genealogy, and that is the line that will ultimately bring us to Jesus Christ. And so the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. And of Cush was Seba and Havilah. And he gives the various sons of Cush. Cush begat Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. The word Nimrod means rebel. The mighty hunter is not a, before the Lord, is not in a good sense. It is in a rebellious sense, really against the Lord. Nimrod is really the founder of the Babylonian religious system, of which there are many fascinating characteristics if you get into the Babylonian religion founded by Nimrod. Nimrod had a wife whose name was Semiramis. Nimrod became a dictator of sorts. He established a civilization of which he became the dictator. And his wife Semiramis became known as the Queen of Heaven. She had a son which she claimed to be virgin born. She named him Tammuz. And obviously Tammuz was being groomed to be the center of worship. Tammuz was out hunting when a wild boar turned on him and gored him. And he lay there dead for 3 days before he was found. But when he was found, he revived. And they began to celebrate the birth of Tammuz. By a very interesting celebration that took place the 25th of December. And they would set on the evening before a log on the fire, the Yule log, as it was known. And it would be consumed in the fire. But the next morning, there would be a new tree brightly decorated in the house. The revived Yule log that had burned now becomes a beautifully decorated tree in the home. It was an evergreen tree, which was a symbol of perpetuated life. It stays green. It is not deciduous. It doesn't die out. To celebrate his resurrection from the 3 days of death having been gored by the While boar, they began to decorate eggs. And in the springtime of the year would have a great celebration, which later became known as Ashtart, named after the Greek name for his mother. And the egg, of course, again is a symbol of continued life. The perpetuation again of life. Now, as we declare a few simple facts to you, I think that you can realize that 2 plus 2 equals 4. And suddenly we are shocked as we realize the origin of some of those things that we have come to practice year by year in our celebrations. The shocking thing is that we have no biblical base for our celebration, but there is a very strong pagan base for our celebration as it goes all the way back to Nimrod the rebel and his wife Semiramis, who was adored as the queen of heaven, who bore the son Tammuz, who became worshipped by the people. And we find that Satan established his counterfeit extremely early in the history of man there in Babylon. And that is why Babylon has become associated with the false religious systems and become synonymous with it in the scripture and in scripture typology. Now, we realize that these Babylonian practices have become inculcated deeply in the structure of the church. And the church has carried along a lot of these same Babylonian practices. Promotes them because it promotes great attendance. You can get some people to church a couple days a year. You can't get any other time. So it pays the church to promote the Babylonian celebrations. And when Jesus addresses the church, when he comes to the church of Pergamos, he declares his displeasure with Pergamos because of some of the practices that they have begun to incorporate. And when he gets to Thyatira, he comes down heavy because they have fully incorporated then these practices within the church. You see, it was during the period of Constantine that the church became the state religion. But in making it the state religion, Constantine sought to bring together the pagan religions with Christianity and created the marriage of paganism and Christianity, taking the pagan celebrations, which was the Saturnalia of the pagan, and incorporating it into the church calendar, calling it Christmas and the celebration of the birthday of Christ. And so the marriage of them brought Babylon into the church. And when Jesus speaks historically of the Protestant Reformation, the Church of Sardis, his complaint of Sardis is that they did not pull completely away from the Babylonian practices. I have not found your works complete before God. Yes, you pulled out of a system deeply steeped in Babylonian practices, but you didn't come all the way out. And as the Lord then really comes down heavy in chapters 17 of the book of Revelation on the Babylonian system that had invaded the church, and he speaks of the coming judgment of God against this Babylonian system that goes back to Nimrod, Semiramis, Tammuz, when he comes down heavy on it, He cries, come out of her, my people. Do not be the partaker with her evil deeds. And God's cry to bring them out of Babylon. So, it is quite fascinating to realize that Satan developed his own counterfeit to God's plan, which he knew. And it would seem that God had set his plan somehow in the stars, which were set for signs and for seasons. And that the gospel is really there in the signs of the zodiac. But astrology has become a perversion of that. And of course, that all came about again at the time of Nimrod, who was one of the instigators in building this Tower of Babel to reach into heaven. And astrology goes back to the perversion of those signs that God established to tell the story of redemption of man. Now, when the birth of Christ took place, there were still men in the east from the area of Babylon who understood the true message of the stars, could read the message of the stars, and were brought to find the king that was born, that they might worship him. But as I said, astrology has become a tremendous perversion of these signs that God had established in the heavens as signs and for seasons. There's a lot that you can read on that if you find that subject sort of interesting. There are books that you can get that would give you some interesting insights on the zodiac and the message of the gospel within the zodiac, the gospel within the stars. Also, if you're interested in a more detailed study of the ethnic origins and all that we find here in the 10th chapter, Dr. Henry Morris, in his book, The Genesis Record, traces each one of the national roots of these sons of Noah's sons. And so you can follow ethnic backgrounds. But basically, the descendants of Japheth were the Indo-Europeans. The descendants of Ham were the Phoenicians, the Egyptians, those within the African continent, and also the Orientals were probably the descendants also of Ham. There is the Sino relationship here of one of the sons of descendants of Ham, which they usually relate to the Orientals. You read of China referred to as the Sino. Then you have in verse 17 the Sinite, from which you get the Sino, Japanese war, things of that nature. Now, he brings you these descendants down to verse 18, and he said, afterward, the families of the Canaanites were dispersed. That is, again, at the time of the Tower of Babel, the dispersion, and Shem lost track of them. He was able to keep track of them as long as they were living in a community more or less together until the time of the Tower of Babel when the confusion, they were scattered into their separate national groups and areas of the world where they migrated. The borders of the Canaanites were from Sidon, which, of course, the Phoenicians, it is even in our news today, isn't it interesting that this city has continued to exist to the present day, and Sidon has been much in the news of late, but that is the area of southern Lebanon there, the borders of the Canaanites, and Sidon was the son of Canaan, who was the son of Ham, who was cursed. And of course, the Phoenicians were not black, and so that sort of blows the theory that Canaan was black, and that was his curse. It's just a stupid thing that was promoted by the slave traders. As far as Gaza, in the land of Canaan, then was that land along the coast inhabited by the Philistines from Sidon to Gaza. Then as you go towards Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, as far as Lasha. And so these were the sons of Ham, verse 20, according to their families, their languages, their lands, and their nations. Now the third son, Ham, or Shem, he's now going to give his own descendants, and he's able to follow them down, actually, as long as he lived, which means that he is the one who brings us to Abraham. And in chapter 11, we will get Shem's descendants clear on down to Abraham. So to Shem were Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, Aram, the sons of Aram were Uz, Hul, Gether, Mash, and so forth. And these names, what do they mean to you? Nothing. They mean nothing to me. Except in verse 24, we get to Eber, and that is the origin of the name of the Hebrews. And the Hebrews were originally much more than just the descendants of Abraham. There are many lines of the Hebrae or the Hebrews. To Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg. We're only interested in him because his name means division. For in the days, in his days, the earth was divided. Now there are those who believe that there was a second cataclysmic change that took place, probably at the time of the Tower of Babel. Not only were their languages mixed, but the earth was divided, and thus we find the records of the Indians in Central and South America going back to this period of time, and in their ancient records we find the stories of the flood. And of course the stories of the flood are endemic to every nation around the world, showing the common origin of the nations. A lot of times the stories are highly exaggerated. But the basic story is that there was a tremendous flood that destroyed the earth, and a single man with his family escaped by building a boat. And that's the general essence of the stories of the flood that you find in every ethnic group. Go back far enough in their history and their legends and their stories, there is that story of the flood, showing that they came from a common base, that they spread out from that common base. The story changed as it went in many areas. So, in his days, the earth was divided. And we get the other descendants, and again, names mean so little to us. You do get to a Jobab, and there are those who believe that he was the Job in verse 29 of Scripture, and that it is a reference to that man after whom a book of poetry was written, which many scholars believe is actually the oldest book of the Bible, is the book of Job. As far as the time of it being written, they believe that Job, the book of Job, was written even before Moses sat down and wrote the first five books. That at that time, the book of Job was in existence, and the oldest book of literature is indeed the book of Job. And so he existed there before the Tower of Babel. So the sons of Shem, according to their families and the languages and the lands and the nations. And we'll have to get into chapter 11 the next time. And it looks like we're plodding through and probably won't get much faster as we go. So we may have hit our pace of 2 chapters a week. If so, I'll retire when we finish the Bible this time. May the Lord richly bless your life. My heart is deeply disturbed over the conditions of the world in which we live. Not for myself. I'm able to handle it. I know I'm going to be checking out before too much longer. I'm going to escape this mess. But my heart hurts for my grandchildren. When I see the pollution so commonplace, a little girl here in our own school was heard talking about going all the way with a boy in fourth grade. It hurts me. When we did an examination or went into the story, found out that her parents have X-rated movies on their video at home, Playboy Channel. That's where she got the ideas. Hurts me. That we've opened this horrible Pandora's box. As God said concerning the nation of Israel, they have sowed the wind, and now they will reap the whirlwind. God said, don't be deceived. God isn't mocked. Whatever a man sows, that he's also going to reap. And if you sow to the flesh, you're going to reap corruption. And it is true. People have sown to the flesh and we're beginning to reap the corruption. In a corrupted society, in a corrupted world. And I am disturbed, deeply disturbed over the corruption. It's time that we as the people of God begin to establish some standards. And as God exhorted, come out from among them and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing. And I will be a father to you, and ye shall be my sons and daughters. I don't know if there is an escape at this point. We've gone so low. Men like Norman Lear being able to produce so many popular TV shows, and yet he's in a crusade against Christianity. Wrote a letter recently to his vast mailing list encouraging people to write President Kennedy to discourage him from appointing any other Christians to any other major position in government. I think we ought to counter that, and we ought to write to the president and encourage him to appoint men of high moral values and standards. But I'm upset, I'm disturbed. My heart hurts for my grandkids. But may God preserve you pure and holy. May you be unspotted from the world in which you live. You have it tougher than I. I live in a sheltered kind of environment. You know, with people wherever I go, they know I'm a minister, and they clean up their language and everything else. And I live in a sheltered environment. You have to be out there where you really get the brunt. You know, and it's just wham, wham. Wham, Satan is assaulting like everything. And my heart goes out to you. I pray that God will strengthen you. That God will help you to make a stand, a commitment. A full commitment. to live a life of purity and righteousness and holiness before God. And that God will strengthen you and help you this week. It may entail doing a little cleaning up around the house. It may be getting rid of some of these magazines. It's terrible. Because these magazines that are lying around the house, the little kids get an interest and kick out of them. You may just leave it there on the table, but your little children can pick it up and look through it, and their minds can be polluted. You may say, well, I can handle it, you know. I just do it for whatever you do it for. But its effect upon the children. God help us. God help us to make a break from the world. To realize that the world is going to perish very soon. God's judgment is going to come. He cannot delay much longer. I really just am so disturbed. There's one part of me that says escape. Time to head for your little island in the South Pacific. That's true. I've got one picked out down there on the map. I've never been there, and I no doubt will never be there, but I just think, God help us. You know, look at you young people. I realize the pressures you're facing, and my heart goes out to you. I pray that somehow God will work in your life by His Spirit in such a powerful way that you can live apart from this world. May the Lord help you this week and strengthen you this week and be with you in a very special way, ministering His love, His power, walking in His righteousness. For His glory.